This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Fork, the Witch and the Worm. Tales from Alagasia. Volume 1, Eragon. By Christopher Paolini. With Angela Paolini writing as Angela the Herbalist in On the Nature of Stars. Read for you by Gerard Doyle. Part 1. The Fork. Chapter 1. Mount Angor. The day had not gone well. Eragon leaned back in his chair and took a long drink of blackberry mead from the mug by his hand. Sweet warmth blossomed in his throat, and with it, memories of summer afternoons spent picking berries in Palancar Valley. A pang of homesickness struck him. The mead had been the best thing to come out of his meeting with Hruthmund, the dwarven representative, a gift to strengthen the bonds of friendly association between dwarves and riders, or so Hruthmund had claimed. Eragon snorted, some friendship. He'd spent the whole meeting arguing with Hruthmund over when the dwarves would deliver the supplies they'd promised. Hruthmund seemed to believe once every 3 to 4 months was more than sufficient, which was absurd, considering the dwarves lived closer to the academy than any of the other races. Even Nasawada had managed to send monthly shipments from the other side of the Haderach Desert, far to the west. I'll have to arrange a talk with Oryk and sort it out with him directly. Just one more thing to do, amid a seemingly endless sea of tasks. Eragon eyed the mounds of scrolls, books, maps, and loose pieces of parchment that covered the desk in front of him, all of which required his attention. He sighed, finding the sight depressing. He shifted his gaze out the large, rough-hewn windows that fronted the eyrie. Rays of evening light streamed across the windswept plains that lay below, surrounding Mount Angor. To the north and west, the Edda River gleamed like a ribbon of beaten silver draped across the landscape. A pair of ships lay docked along the nearest bend, and from that docking, a trail led south to the foothills piled about the base of Angor. The mountain had been Eragon's choice in consultation with Saphira and their traveling companions for the Dragon Rider's new home. It was more than that, too, a safeguard for the Eldonari, and hopefully, a nesting ground for the next generation of dragons. The high, slab-sided peak was a trailing remnant of the Beor Mountains, shorter than those towering giants, but still many times bigger than the Mountains of the Spine Eragon had grown up with. It stood alone in the green expanse of the eastern reaches, 2 weeks of slow sailing beyond the bounds of Alagasia proper. South of Angor, the land was rumpled like a blanket, and ruffled with trees whose leaves shone silver in the wind, bright as the scales of a fish. Farther to the east stood scarps and cliffs, and huge flat-topped pillars of stone, crested with piles of vegetation. Among them lived groups of wandering tribes, strange, half-wild humans the likes of which Eragon had never encountered before. So far they had proven no trouble, but he remained wary. Such was his responsibility now. The mountain bore many names. Angor was dwarvish for White Mountain, and indeed the upper thirds were clad in snow and ice, and from a distance the peak glowed with a startling brilliance amid the verdant plains. But it also had an older, secret name in dwarvish. For as the expedition Eragon led had begun to settle among the foothills of the mountain, they had discovered tunnels burrowed into the stone beneath, and there, in runes, inscribed Gor na Velen, which meant Mountain of Gems. Some ancient clan or tribe of dwarfs had sunk mines deep into the roots of the peak. The dwarves who had joined Aragorn's group had been excited by their discovery, and they spent much time debating who had made the mines and what gems might still be found. In the ancient language, the mountain was known as Felthindari, which meant Mountain of Night. The elves could not tell Aragorn where the name came from, nor the reason for it, so he rarely used it. But he also heard them refer to the peak as Veta, or Hope. He found this fitting, as the dragon riders were a hope for all the races of Alagasia. The Urgals had their own name for the peak, Ungvek. When Aragorn asked them what it meant, they claimed it was strong-headed, but he wasn't so sure. Then, too, there were the humans. Aragorn had heard them use all of the names interchangeably, as well as refer to the mountain as Horsepike, a term he suspected the traders often used in jest. Personally, Aragorn preferred the sound of Arngor, but he gave each of the names the respect they were due. The confusion surrounding them embodied the situation at the academy. The place was a mix of races and cultures and conflicting agendas, and all of them still unsettled. He took another sip of the Mununvlor's mead. That was how Hruthmund had named the bottle. Mununvlor's. Aragorn turned the name over on his tongue, feeling the shape of it as he attempted to pick out the meaning. There had been other problems throughout the day, not just the meeting with Hruthmund. The Urgals had been belligerent as always, the humans fractious, the dragons in their Eldenari enigmatic, and the elves... The elves were elegant and efficient and polite to a fault, but once they made a decision they would not or could not change their minds. Dealing with them had proven far more frustrating than Aragorn had anticipated, and the more time he spent around them, the more he'd begun to agree with Oryk's opinion of elves. They were best admired from a distance. In addition to the interpersonal difficulties, there were also ongoing concerns regarding the construction of the stronghold, the acquisition of food and other provisions for the upcoming winter, and the myriad of other details that attended the governance of a large town. Which was, in essence, what their expedition had become. A settlement. Soon to be a permanent one. Aragorn drained the last of the mead. He could feel a faint tilt to the floor underneath him as it took effect. Half the morning he'd spent devoting himself to assisting in the actual construction of the hold, and it had consumed far more of his strength and Saphira's than he'd anticipated. No matter how much he ate, it never seemed enough to replace the energy expended. In the last 2 weeks, he'd lost a matching 2 notches on his belt, and that was on top of the notch he'd taken in over the prior weeks. He scowled as he eyed the parchment on the desk. Restoring the race of dragons, leading the riders, and protecting the Eldenari were all responsibilities he wanted, welcomed, and took seriously. And yet, Aragorn had never expected that he would spend so much of his life doing this. Sitting at a desk, laboring over facts and figures until his vision blurred from the strain. As ridiculously stressful as fighting the Empire and facing Galbatorix had been, and Aragorn never, ever wanted to experience anything similar, it had been exciting, too. At times he dreamed of strapping on his sword, Brisinger, getting on Saphira, and setting out to see what adventure they could find. It was just that, though. A dream. They couldn't leave the dragons or the riders to fend for themselves, not for a long while yet. Basul, Aragorn muttered. His scowl deepened as he considered a whole host of curses he could cast on the scraps of parchment. Fire, frost, lightning, wind, obliteration by disintegration, and more besides. He let out his breath, straightened up, and again reached for a quill. Stop, said Saphira. Across the chamber, she stirred in the padded hollow that was sunk into the floor. A nest big enough for a dragon. The same nest where each night Aragorn slept curled up beneath one of her wings. As Saphira rose, flecks of blue refracted from her gem-like scales and spun across the walls in a dazzling display. "I can't," Aragorn said. "I wish I could, but I can't. These manifests have to be checked by morning and..."
"Always there will be work," she said,
walking over to the desk. The tips of her gleaming claws tapped against the stone.
"Always there will be those who need something of us. But you have to take care of yourself, little one. You've done enough for the day. Put aside your pen and let go of your worries. There is still light in the sky. Go spar with Blodgarm or butt heads with Skargarsh, or do something other than sit and smolder."
"No," said Aragorn, fixing his gaze on the rows of runes covering the parchment. "It has to be done, and there isn't anyone else who can do it but me. If I don't..." He jumped as Saphira's left foreclaw stabbed through the pile of parchment, pinning it to the desk and spilling the bottle of ink across the floor.
"Enough,"
she said. She puffed, blowing her hot breath over him. Then she extended her neck and peered at him with one of her glittering, bottomless eyes.
"No more for today. You are not yourself at the moment. Go."
"You can't..."
"Go."
Her lip curled, and a deep rumble emanated from within her chest. Aragorn bit back his words, frustrated. Then he tossed the quill next to her claw.
"Fine."
He pushed the chair away from the desk, stood, and held up his hands.
"Fine. You win. I'm going."
"Good."
A hint of amusement appeared in her eyes, and she pushed him toward the archway with her snout.
"Go, and don't come back until you're in a better mood."
"Humph."
But he smiled as he walked through the arch and started down the wide, curved ramp of stairs outside. Despite his protestations, Aragorn wasn't sorry to be away from his desk. Somewhat to his annoyance, he knew Saphira was well aware of that, but it wasn't worth grouching about something so small. Sometimes it was easier to fight a battle than to figure out how to deal with the more mundane details of life. That was a lesson he was still learning. The steps were shallow, but the walls between them were wide enough for Saphira to pass between with ease. Except for personal quarters, everything in the hold was being built for use by all but the very largest dragons, same as the structures on Vroengard Island, the old home of the dragon riders. It was a necessary feature of the hold, but it meant that building even a single room was a monumental exercise, and most of the chambers were huge and forbidding, even more so than in the great dwarf city of Trondheim. The hold would feel more friendly, Aragorn thought, once they had the time and energy to decorate it. Some banners and tapestries hung on the walls, and a few rugs before the fireplaces would go a long way toward dampening the echoes, adding color, and generally improving the overall impression of the place. So far, the only real addition had been scores of the dwarves' flameless lanterns, which had been mounted in brackets at regular intervals along the walls. Not that there was much to the hold at the moment. A handful of storerooms, a few walls, the eyrie, where he and Saphira slept, high upon a finger of rock, overlooking the rest of the planned citadel. Far more needed to be built and excavated before the complex would begin to resemble anything close to what Aragorn envisioned. He wandered down to the main courtyard, which was nothing more than a square of rough stone, littered with tools, ropes, and tents. The Urgals were wrestling around their fire, as they often did, and though Aragorn watched for a while, he felt no inclination to join in. Two of the elves, Aestrith and Rielven, who were standing guard along the battlements overlooking the foothills below, nodded as he approached. Aragorn returned the gesture and stood some distance away from them, his hands clasped behind his back, while he scented the evening air. Then he went to inspect the construction of the main hall. The dwarves had designed it according to his general plan, and then the elves had refined the details. That had occasioned more than a little argument between the two groups. From the hall, Aragorn went to the storerooms and began to catalogue the crates and barrels of supplies that had arrived the previous day. Despite Saphira's admonishments, he couldn't bring himself to let go of his work. So much yet needed doing, and he never had enough time or energy to accomplish even a fraction of his goals. In the back of his head, he could feel Saphira's faint disapproval that he wasn't out carousing with the dwarves, or sparring with the elves, or doing something, anything, other than work. Yet none of those things appealed to Aragorn. He didn't feel like fighting, didn't feel like reading, didn't feel like devoting energy to activities that wouldn't help him resolve the problems facing them. For it was all resting on him, him and Saphira. Every choice they made affected not only the future of the riders, but the very survival of the dragons. And if they chose badly, both might end. Thoughts like that made it difficult to relax. Driven by his discontent, Aragorn climbed back up the stairs toward the eyrie. Only he turned aside before reaching the top, and through a small side tunnel, entered the chamber they dug out, with spells and pickaxes, directly below. It was a large, disc-shaped chamber. In the center, upon several tiered daises, sat an assortment of glittering Eldunari, mostly those he and Saphira had fetched from the Vault of Souls on Vroengard, but also a few of the Hearts of Hearts that Galbatorix had kept slaved to his will. The rest of the Eldunari, those Galbatorix had driven mad with his spells and mental tortures, were kept stored in a cave deep within the side of Mount Angor. There they could not hurt anyone with the lashings of their unhinged thoughts, and Aragorn hoped, in time, he might be able to heal them with help from the other dragons. But it would be the work of years, if not decades. Had it been up to him, he would have placed all the Eldunari in such caves, along with the many dragon eggs. It was the best way to protect them, the safest sort of strongbox. Aragorn was acutely aware of the risk of theft, despite the many wards he'd set on the chamber. However, Gleda, Umaroth, and the other dragons, still in full possession of their minds, had refused to live underground. As Umaroth said,
"We spent over 100 years locked in the Vault of Souls. Perhaps some day we shall spend another 100 years waiting in darkness. In the meantime, we would feel the light upon our facets."
So it was. The larger Eldunari rested upon the central dais, while the smaller ones had been arranged in rings about them. Piercing the circular wall of the chamber were dozens of narrow lancet windows, which the elves had fitted with pieces of crystal that split the incoming light into flecks of rainbow. No matter the time of day, the north-facing room was always bright and strewn with multi-hued shards, both from the windows and the Eldunari themselves. The dwarves and the elves had taken to calling the room the Hall of Colors, and Aragorn was inclined to agree with the choice. It was a fitting description indeed. He made his way to the center and knelt in front of the sparkling gold-hued gem that was Gleda's Heart of Hearts. The dragon's mind touched his own, and Aragorn felt a vast vista of thought and feeling open up before him. As always, it was a humbling experience.
"What troubles you, Aragorn Finarel?"
Still restless, Aragorn pursed his lips and looked past the Eldunari at the semi-transparent crystal filling the windows. "Too much work. I can't get ahead of it, and because of that I can't bring myself to do anything else. It's wearing on me."
"You must learn to center yourself," said Gleda. "Then these lesser concerns will not bother you."
"I know. And I know there are many, many things I can't control." Aragorn allowed himself a brief, grim smile. "But knowing and doing are two different things." Then another mind joined theirs, that of Umaroth, one of the oldest Eldunari. Out of reflex, Aragorn glanced toward the white Heart of Hearts that contained the dragon's consciousness. Umaroth said,
"What you need is a distraction, that your mind might rest and reset."
"That I do," said Aragorn.
"Then perhaps we can help, Arjatlam. Remember you how my wingmates and I kept watch upon Alagazia from within the Vault of Souls?"
"Yes," said Aragorn, already having an inkling of what the dragon was hinting at. He was right.
"We have continued the practice, Arjatlam, as a means of whiling away the days, but also that we might stay abreast of events and not be surprised by the rise of some new enemy."
More minds joined Umaroth's, the rest of the Eldonari, pressing in around Aragorn's consciousness like a sea of growling voices. As always, it took a concentrated effort to ward them off and keep hold of his own thoughts. "Why am I not surprised?"
"If you wish," said Glaedor, "we can show you some of what we see. A vision of elsewhere that might provide you with a new perspective."
Aragorn hesitated as he considered the offer. "How long will it take?"
"As long as is required, youngling," said Umaroth. "Worrying about the time is exactly what you need curing of. Does the eagle worry about the length of the day? Does the bear or the deer or the fish in the sea? No. So why should you? Chew what you can, and leave the rest for tomorrow."
"All right," said Aragorn. He lifted his chest and took a deep breath as he prepared himself. "Show me then." Inexorable as the onrushing tide, the dragon's minds washed over his own. They swept Aragorn out of his body, out of the Hall of Colors, and away from snow-clad Mount Angor, and all his cares and worries, carrying him toward the familiar yet distant lands of Alagazia. Images blossomed before him, and within them Aragorn saw and felt far more than he'd expected. Chapter 2. A Fork in the Road. It was 2 days past Maddentide, and the first flakes of snow were drifting from the starry sky onto the city of Siunon. Essie didn't notice. She stomped down the cobblestone alley behind the Yarstead house, her mouth set in a hard line and her cheeks burning as she struggled not to cry. She hated stupid, mean Hjordis, with her fake smile and her pretty bows and all her nasty little insults. Hated her. And then there was poor Karth. Essie couldn't stop thinking about his reaction. He had looked so betrayed when she'd pushed him into the trough. He hadn't even said anything, just sat where he had fallen and gaped at her, while his eyes went big and round. Her dress sleeve was still wet from where the muddy water had splashed her. The familiar sound of waves slapping against the underside of the wharves grew louder as she approached the docks. She kept to the alleys, kept to the narrow ways that the adults rarely used. Overhead, a rook with fluffed-out feathers sat perched on the eaves of the sorting house. It cocked its head and opened its beak to utter a mournful cry. Essie shivered, though not from the cold, and pulled her shawl closer around her shoulders. A dog had howled during the night. The candle on the little shelf where they left offerings of milk and bread for the Svartlings had gone out, and now a lone rook had called. Bad omens all. Was there more ill fortune coming her way? She didn't think she could bear anything worse. She slipped between the smelly drying racks by the edge of the fish market and came into the street. Ahead of her, music and conversation sounded, and warm light spilled out of the front of the fulsome feast. The windows of the inn were crystal, specially made by the dwarves, and they gleamed like diamond in the flickering light. It was a point of pride for Essie every time she saw the windows, even now. No other building on the street had anything so pretty. Inside, the common room was as loud and busy as ever. Essie ignored the guests and went to the bar. Papa was there pouring beer, washing out mugs, and serving dishes of smoked herring. He glanced at her as she ducked under the half door at the end of the bar. "You're late," he said.
"Sorry, Papa."
Essie got a plate and loaded it with a heel of bread, a wedge of hard Sartos cheese, and a half-dried apple, all taken from the shelf under the bar. She was still too small to help with the serving, but she would help with the cleaning up later.
And then, later still, once everyone had gone to bed, she would sneak down to the cellar, gather the supplies she needed.
She carried the plate to an empty chair in front of the great stone fireplace. Next to the chair was a small table, and on the other side of it, a second chair, this one with a man sitting in it. He was lean and dark-eyed, with a neat beard and a long black travel cloak bunched around him. A plate balanced on his knee, and he was slowly eating a serving of Mama's roasted turnips and mutton, stabbing at the pieces with one of the inn's iron forks. Essie didn't care. He was just another traveller, like so many who came to the fulsome feast. She plopped down in the free chair and tore off part of the heel of bread, imagining that it was Hjordis's head she was tearing off. She continued to rip at the food with her fingers and teeth, and she chewed with a ferocity that was oddly satisfying. She still felt as if she was about to cry, which just made her more angry. Crying was for little children. Crying was for weaklings who got pushed around and told what to do. That wasn't her. She made a noise of frustration as she bit into the apple and the stem got stuck in the gap between her front teeth. "You seem upset," the man next to her said in a mild tone. Essie scowled. She plucked the stem from between her teeth and flung it into the fireplace.
"It's all Hjordis's fault."
Papa didn't like her talking to the guests too much, but she had never minded him. The visitors always had interesting stories, and many of them would ruffle her hair and comment on how adorable she was, and give her candied nuts or syrup twists. In the winter, at least. "Oh?" said the man. He put down his fork and turned in his seat to better look at her. "And who is this Hjordis?"
"She's the daughter of Yerrik. He's the Earl's chief mason,"
said Essie, sullen.
"I see. Does that make her important?"
Essie shook her head.
"It makes her think she's important."
"What did she do to upset you, then?"
"Everything."
Essie took a savage bite out of the apple and chewed so hard and quick she bit the inside of her mouth. She winced and swallowed, trying to ignore the pain. The man drank from the mug by his hand.
"Most interesting," he said,
and used a napkin to dab a fleck of foam off his moustache.
"Well then, is it a tale you feel like telling? Perhaps talking about it will make you feel better."
Essie looked at him, slightly suspicious. He had an open face, but there was an intensity to his dark eyes, and a slight hardness, too, that she wasn't sure about.
"Papa wouldn't want me to bother you?"
"I have some time," said the man easily. "I'm just waiting for a certain associate of mine who, alas, happens to be habitually late. If you wish to share your tale of woe, then please, consider me your devoted audience."
He used a lot of big words, and his accent wasn't one Essie was familiar with. It seemed overly careful, as if he were sculpting the air with his tongue. Despite that, and despite the hardness of his eyes, she decided he seemed like a nice person. She bounced her feet off the legs of the chair.
"Well, I'd like to tell you, but I can't possibly unless we're friends."
"Is that so? And how do we become friends?"
"You have to tell me your name, silly."
The man smiled. He had pretty teeth.
"Of course. How foolish of me.
In that case, my name is Tornek."
And he held out his hand.
His fingers were long and pale, but strong-looking. His nails were trimmed square.
Essie Sigling's daughter.
She could feel a row of calluses on his palm as they shook hands.
Very nice to meet you, Essie.
Now then, what seems to be bothering you? Essie stared at the partially eaten apple in her hand. She sighed and put it back on the plate.
It's all Hjordis's fault.
So you said.
She's always being mean to me and making her friends tease me.
Tornak's expression grew serious.
That's not good at all.
Encouraged, Essie shook her head, allowing her outrage to shine forth.
No. I mean, sometimes they tease me anyway, but, Hjordis, when she's there it gets really bad.
Is that what happened today?
Yes, sort of.
She broke off a piece of cheese and nibbled on it, while she thought back over the past few weeks. Tornak waited patiently. She liked that about him. He reminded her of a cat. Finally, she gathered the courage to say,
Before harvest, Hjordis started being nicer to me. I thought maybe things were going to be better. She even invited me to her house.
Essie glanced at Tornak.
It's right by the castle.
Impressive.
Essie nodded, glad he understood.
She gave me one of her ribbons, a yellow one, and said that I could come to a Maddentide party.
And did you?
Another bob of her head.
It was today.
Hot tears filled her eyes, and she blinked furiously, disappointed with herself.
Here now, said Tornak, looking concerned.
He held out a square of soft white cloth.
At first, Essie was reluctant to accept.
The cloth was so clean.
But then the tears started running down her cheeks, and she grabbed the kerchief and wiped her eyes.
Thank you, mister.
Another small smile appeared on the man's face.
It's been a long time since I've been called mister, but you're very welcome.
I take it the party didn't go well. Essie scowled and pushed the kerchief back toward him.
She wasn't going to cry any more. Not her.
The party was fine. It was Hjordis. She got mean again, after, and...
Essie took a deep breath, as if to fill her stomach with courage.
And she said that if I didn't do what she wanted, she would tell her father not to use our inn during the solstice celebration.
She peered at Tornak, wondering if he knew why that was so important.
All the masons come here to drink, and...
She hiccuped, despite herself.
They drink a lot, and it means they spend stacks and stacks of coppers.
Tornak put his plate on the table and leaned toward her. His cloak rustled like the wind in the thatching. His face was very serious.
What did she want you to do?
Ashamed, Essie stared at her muddy shoes.
She wanted me to push Karth into a horse trough,
she said, tripping over the words in her rush to get them out.
Karth is a friend of yours.
Essie nodded, miserable.
They'd known each other since she was three.
He lives on the docks. His father is a fisher.
So he wouldn't get invited to a party like this?
No, but Hjordis sent her handmaid to bring him to the house and...
Essie stared at Tornak, her expression fierce.
I didn't have no choice. If I hadn't pushed him, then she would have told her father not to come to the fulsome feast.
I understand, said Tornak in a soothing tone. So you pushed your friend. Were you able to apologize to him?
No,
Essie said, feeling even worse.
I ran. But everyone saw. He won't want to be friends with me anymore. No one will. Hjordis just meant to trick me, and I hate her.
Essie grabbed the apple and took another quick bite. Her teeth clacked together.
Tornark opened his mouth to say something, but at that moment Papa came by, on his way to deliver a pair of mugs to a table by the wall. He gave her a disapproving look. "My daughter isn't making a nuisance of herself, is she, Master Tornark? She has a bad habit of pestering guests when they're trying to eat." "Not at all," said Tornark, smiling. "I've been on the road for far too long, with nothing but the sun and the moon for company. A bit of conversation is exactly what I need. In fact..." His fingers dipped under his belt, and Essie saw a flash of silver as he reached out to her father. "Perhaps you can see to it that the tables next to us remain clear. I'm expecting an associate of mine, and we have some, business to discuss." The coins disappeared into his apron, and Papa bobbed his head. "Of course, Master Tornack." He glanced at her again, his expression slightly concerned, and then continued on his way. Essie felt a sudden pang of remorse. Papa was going to be so sad when she was gone. But there was no other choice. She had to leave. "Now then," said Tornack, stretching his long legs out toward the fire. "You were telling me your tale of woe, Essie Sigling's daughter. Was that the full accounting?"
"That was it,"
Essie said in a small voice. Tornark picked up the fork from his plate and began to twirl it between his fingers. She found the sight vaguely entrancing. "Things can't be as bad as you think. I'm sure if you explain to your friend..."
"No,"
she said, firm. She knew Karth. He wouldn't forgive her for what she'd done. None of her friends along the docks would. They'd think she turned against them to join Hjordis and the other children by the castle. And in a way, she had.
"He won't understand. He won't trust me again. They'll hate me for it."
A cutting edge entered Tornak's voice. "Then maybe they weren't really your friends."
Essie couldn't bear the thought. "They were. You don't understand."
And she brought her fist down on the arm of the chair in an impatient stamp.
"Karth is... he's really nice. Everyone likes him, and now they won't like me. You wouldn't know. You're all big and old."
Tornak's eyebrows climbed toward his hairline. "You might be surprised what I know." "So they won't like you. What are you going to do about it?" Essie didn't mean to say, but the words slipped out of her before she thought better of it.
"I'm going to run away."
The moment she realized what she'd done, she gave Tornark a panicked look.
"Don't tell Papa, please."
Tornark took another sip from his mug and then smoothed his beard. He didn't seem upset by her plan, not the way Essie knew Papa would be. Rather, he seemed to be taking her seriously, which Essie liked. "And where would you go?" he asked. Essie had already been thinking about that.
"South, where it's warm. There's a caravan leaving tomorrow. The foreman comes here. He's nice. I can sneak out and then ride with them to Gilead."
Tornark picked at his fork with the tip of a fingernail. "And then?" After that, things got a bit hazy in Essie's mind, but she knew what her ultimate goal would be.
"I want to visit the Beor Mountains and see the dwarves," she said. The thought excited her. "They made our windows. Aren't they pretty?"
She pointed.
"They certainly are," said Tornark.
"Have you ever visited the Beor Mountains?"
"I have," said Tornark. "Once, long ago." Impressed, Essie looked at him with renewed interest.
"Really? Are they as tall as everyone says?"
"So tall, the peaks aren't even visible."
She leaned back in her chair as she tried to picture that. The effort made her dizzy.
"How wonderful!"
A snort escaped Tornark.
"If you don't count being shot at with arrows, then yes."
"You do realize, Essie Sigling's daughter, that running away won't solve your problems here,"
Of course not, she said.
His statement seemed very obvious to her.
But if I leave, then Hjordis can't bother me any more.
Essie made a face. Tornak almost looked as if he were going to laugh, but then he took another sip from his mug, and afterward he seemed more solemn.
Or, and this is just a suggestion, you could try to fix the problem instead of running away.
It can't be fixed, she said, stubborn.
What about your parents? I'm sure they would miss you terribly. Do you really want to make them suffer like that?
Essie crossed her arms. This wasn't going the way she wanted. Tornak had been agreeable so far. Why was he arguing with her now?
They had my brother and my sister and Olfa. He's only two, she pouted. They wouldn't miss me.
I very much doubt that, said Tornak.
Besides, think what you did with Hjordis. You helped protect the fulsome feast. If your parents understood the sacrifice you made, I'm sure they would be very proud.
Said Essie, unconvinced.
There wouldn't have been a problem if it wasn't for me. I'm the problem. If I go away, everything will be all right.
Feeling determined, she picked up the apple core and threw it into the great fireplace. A whirl of sparks flew up the chimney, and she heard the sizzle of water exploding into steam. In an overly casual tone, Tornak said, What is that?
What?
She said. There, on your arm. Essie looked down and saw her sleeve had ridden up, exposing the twisted red scar on her left wrist. Ashamed, she tugged the cuff down.
Nothing,
she mumbled. May I? Said Tornak, and held out his hand toward her. At first, Essie hesitated, but he seemed so polite and so assured that at last she relented and let him take her arm. As gently as her mother would, Tornak pulled back the cuff of her sleeve. Essie turned her head away. She didn't need to see the scar again, didn't need to look, to know how it crawled up her forearm all the way to her elbow. She hoped no one else in the common room would notice. After a moment, she felt Tornak pull her sleeve back down, and he said,
That is a very impressive scar. You should be proud of it.
Confused, she looked back at him.
Why? It's ugly, and I hate it.
A faint smile played around the corners of his lips. Because a scar means you survived. It means you're tough and hard to kill. It means you lived. A scar is something to admire.
You're wrong, said Essie.
She pointed at the pot with the painted bluebells on the mantel, the one Auntie Helena had given them last winter, the one Essie had knocked onto the floor a few moons back. A long crack ran from the lip of the pot to the base.
It just means you're broken.
Ah, said Tornak in a soft voice. But sometimes, if you work very hard, you can mend a break so that it's stronger than before. Essie wasn't liking their conversation as much as she had earlier. She crossed her arms, tucking her left hand into her armpit.
Hjordis and the others always make fun of me for it, she mumbled. They say my arm is as red as a snapper, and that I'll never get a husband because of it.
And what do your parents say? Essie made a face.
That it doesn't matter. But that's not true, is it?
Tornak inclined his head. No. I suppose it isn't. Your parents are doing their best to protect you, though.
Well, they can't, she said, and huffed.
She glanced at him. The darkness had returned to his face, but it didn't seem to be directed at her.
Do you have any scars?
She asked. A humorless laugh escaped him. Oh, yes. He pointed at a small white mark on his chin. This one is only a few months old. A friend of mine gave it to me by accident while we were playing around. The big oaf,
A hint of affection lightened Tornak's expression. Then he said, "What happened to your arm?" It took Essie a while to answer. All she could see in her head was the inn's kitchen that morning 3 years ago, and all she could hear were Mama's frantic cries. "It was an accident," she mumbled. "A pot with hot water fell onto my arm." Tornak's eyes narrowed. "It just fell on you?" Essie nodded. She didn't want to mention that it had been Papa who bumped her. But it hadn't been his fault. She'd been running around the kitchen, and he hadn't seen her. And Essie knew he felt terrible about what had happened. Tornak was staring at the fire, the sparks and embers reflecting in his eyes. Essie looked at him, curious. "Where are you from?" she asked.
"A long, long way from here."
"In the south?"
"Yes, in the south."
She kicked her feet against the chair.
"What's it like there?"
If she was going to run away, she ought to know what to expect. Tornak inhaled slowly and tilted his head back so he was gazing at the ceiling. "It depends where you go. There are hot places and cold places, and places where the wind never stops blowing. Forests seemingly without end, caves that burrow into the deepest parts of the earth, and plains full of vast herds of red deer."
"Are they monsters?"
she asked. "Of course," he said, returning his gaze to her.
"There are always monsters. Some of them even look like humans."
"I ran away from home myself, you know."
"You did?"
He nodded. "I was older than you, but yes, I ran. But I didn't escape what I was running from." "Listen to me, Essie. I know you think leaving will make everything better, but..."
"There you are, Tornak of the Road," said a sly, slithering voice that made the hair on the back of Essie's neck prickle.
A man stepped forward between the tables. He was thin and stooped, with a patched cloak draped over his shoulders and ragged clothes underneath. Rings glittered on his fingers. Essie took an instant dislike to the man. He smelled of wet fur, and something about the way he moved and looked gave her a warning feeling in her gut.
"Saros," said Tornak, a flicker of distaste on his face. "I've been waiting for you."
"The reaches are dangerous these days," said Saros.
He picked up an empty chair and placed it between Essie and Tornak, and then sat facing both of them. Essie noticed several more men had entered the common room from the street, six of them. They were rough-looking, but not like the fishermen. They wore furs and leathers and had a wild appearance, similar to the trappers who came in during spring. Papa often had to throw them out because they made too much trouble. Over by the bar, Papa watched the newcomers, wary. He pulled out his leather-wrapped truncheon and laid it next to his washcloth as a silent warning. The sight comforted Essie. She had seen him settle even the meanest drunks with a few well-placed blows. Saros pointed at her with one long, grimy forefinger.
"We have business to discuss. Send the youngling away."
"I have nothing to hide," said Tornak smoothly. "She can stay."
He glanced at her. "If you're interested, you might learn something useful of the world by it." Essie shrank back in her seat, but she didn't leave. Tornak's words tickled her curiosity. Also, for some reason, she couldn't help but remember the bad omens from earlier, and she felt that if she did leave, something horrible would happen to Tornak. A long hiss sounded between Saros's teeth as he shook his head.
"Foolish wanderer." "Do as you wish, then. I'll not argue. Even if you put your foot crosswise."
A glint of steel appeared in Tornak's gaze.
"No, you won't."
"Tell me then, what have you found?
It's been 3 months and...
Saras waved a hand.
Yes, yes. 3 months. I told you, the reaches are dangerous. But I found word of what you seek. Better than word, I found this.
From the leather wallet on his belt, he produced a fist-sized chunk of black... something, that he thumped down on the table. Essie leaned forward, as did Tornak. The something was a piece of rock, but there was a deep shine to it, unlike any rock Essie had seen, as if a smouldering coal were buried in the centre. She sniffed, and then wrinkled her nose.
Yuck! It smelled as bad as a rotten egg!
Tornak looked at the rock as if he wasn't sure he believed it existed.
What exactly is that?
Saros lifted his shoulders, shrugging like the herons along the docks.
Suspicions of shadows are all I have, but you sought the unusual, the out of place, and that there doesn't fit in the normal frame.
Were there more, or...
Saros nodded. I am told. A whole field, scattered with stones. Black and burnt, as if seared by fire, but with no sign of flame or smoke.
Essie said,
Where is it from?
Saros smiled, unpleasantly. His teeth, she noticed, had been sharpened to points. The sight disgusted her more than it frightened her.
Well now, that there is the nub of it, youngling. Yes, indeed.
Tornak reached for the rock, and Saros dropped a hand over the shiny chunk, caging it behind his fingers.
No, he said. Coin first, wanderer.
Tornak pressed his lips together, and then produced a small leather pouch from under his heavy cloak. The clink of metal sounded as he put it on the table.
Saros's smile widened.
He tugged loose the pouch's drawstring, and Essie glimpsed a yellow gleam inside.
She took a sharp breath. Gold! She'd never even seen a whole crown before.
Half no, said Tornak, and the rest when you tell me where you found that.
He poked the rock with the tip of a finger. A strange choking sound came from Saros. It took Essie a second to realize that the man was laughing. Then he said,
Oh no, wanderer, no indeed. I think instead you should give us the rest of your coin, and perhaps then we'll let you keep your head.
Across the common room, the fur-clad men slipped hands under their cloaks, and Essie saw the hilts of swords half hidden beneath. She stiffened, and panicked, looked to her father. A guest had distracted him. One of the labourers from the dock stood leaning against the bar, chattering away. She opened her mouth and was about to cry out a warning when Saros drew a thin-bladed knife and pressed it against her throat.
Uh-uh, he said. Not a peep from you, youngling, or I'll open your throat from stem to stern. Fear froze Essie in place. She could barely breathe. She was so scared of the razor edge touching her skin, cold and deadly.
Suddenly, all of her previous worries didn't seem important in the slightest. Papa could save her, she felt sure he could, but only if he knew she was in trouble. She kept glancing toward the bar, hoping Papa would somehow sense her thoughts. The hardness in Tornak's eyes grew even more flinty, but otherwise he remained as calm as ever.
Why the turn of face, Saros? I'm paying you good money.
Yes, that's the point.
Saros leaned in closer, lips pulled wide. His breath stank of rotting meat.
If you are willing to pay this wise much for hints and rumours, then you must have more coin than sense. Much more coin.
Essie considered kicking him in the shin, but she was too scared of the knife to try. A frown formed on Tornak's brow, and she heard him mutter a bad word under his breath. Then he said,
This isn't a fight you want. Tell me the location. Take the gold you're owed, and no one has to get hurt.
What fight? Said Saros, and cackled. You have no sword on you. We are six, and you are one. The coin is ours, whether you wish it or not.
Essie stiffened as the steel bit into her neck, a bright little slice of pain.
See? Said Saros. I make the choice easy for you, Wanderer. Hand over the rest of your gold, or the youngling here will pay with blood.
Essie held her breath as she watched Tornak. Part of her expected him to pull out a hidden dagger and do something dangerous and heroic. He seemed like that kind of person. Part of her hoped he would rescue her. Instead, all Tornak did was utter a sentence of strange words. The air in front of him seemed to shiver, but nothing else happened. Essie didn't know what he was trying to do, but it wasn't helping. Saros chuckled again.
Foolish, very foolish.
With his free hand, he pulled out a bird skull amulet from under his jerkin.
Do you see this, Wanderer? The witch woman Bashel charmed a necklace for each of us. Your weirding ways won't help you now. We're protected against all evilness.
Is that so? Said Tornak.
And then he spoke a word, and such a word it was. It rang like a bell, and in the sound Essie thought she heard all possible meanings. And yet, when she tried to recall the word itself, no memory of it remained.
A dull silence followed. Everyone in the common room looked at Tornak, many of the guests with a dazed expression, as if they'd just woken from a dream.
Magic!
Essie stared wide-eyed, so amazed she nearly forgot her fear. No one was supposed to use magic these days, not unless they had the approval of the Queen's spellcasters, the Duvrangogata. But Essie had always wanted to see the sort of magic the old stories talked about. Despite the ringing word, Saros appeared unharmed. And for the first time, Tornak seemed perturbed.
Essie, said Papa.
He grabbed his truncheon and sprang over the bar.
You let her go now.
Before he could take more than a step, two of the fur-clad men charged him and knocked him to the floor. A dull thunk sounded as one of them struck Papa on the head with the pommel of a sword. He moaned and dropped the truncheon. No one else dared move.
Papa!
Essie cried. If not for the knife at her throat, she would have rushed to his side. She'd never seen her father lose a fight before, and the sight of him on the floor removed any last sense of safety. Again, Saros chuckled. Louder than before.
Your tricks will not help you, Wanderer. No enchantments are as strong as Bashel's. No magic is deeper.
Perhaps you're right, said Tornak. He seemed calm again, which Essie couldn't understand. He picked up the fork and began to fiddle with it.
Well then, it appears I have no choice in the matter.
None whatsoever, said Saros, smug.
Mama appeared in the doorway to the kitchen, wiping her hands on her apron.
What is all this?
She started to say, and then saw Saros holding the knife and Papa lying on the floor, and her face went pale.
Don't cause no trouble or your man gets stuck,
said one of the fur-clad ruffians, pointing his blade at Papa. While everyone else was distracted by Mama, Essie saw Tornak's lips twitch as he spoke without voice, and a flame-like ripple ran the length of the fork. If she'd blinked, she would have missed it. Saros slapped the table.
Enough with the yapping. Your coin, now.
Tornak tipped his head and with his left hand again reached under his cloak. One moment he was sitting, seemingly relaxed. Then he moved faster than Essie could follow.
His cloak swung through the air, sending a rush of wind into her face, and his fork flashed across the table, and she heard a ting.